And it is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Thanks for being with us this morning. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. And today, we're just going to have fun. I mean, can we have fun today?
Are you looking at me like you're asking me? Is it a rhetorical question?
Yes.
I have fun every day.
And our guest live in the studio is David Walker. We're celebrating with David. We're celebrating. It's the 15th anniversary of David's culture blog, Badass Mofo. And he's just come out with this juicy book, Why Is the Brother Gotta Die? We're talking about movies. We're talking about culture. And David, you know, as I already mentioned to you on Democracy Now! All this week, it actually started last week, Amy Goodman is broadcasting live from Park City, Utah, because it's the Sundance Film Festival, and she's had very cool filmmakers on and people who are there because there's films about them. And this morning she was talking with Harry Belafonte. She's going to be stretching out that Harry Belafonte interview for the whole week, and his voice is gravelly, 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 but it's amazing. So there's a documentary about his life. And last week she spoke with Danny Glover, who produced a documentary about the Black Panthers. But we're pretty thrilled to be here with you. You are our piece of...
I'm thrilled just to be compared to both Harry Belafonte and Danny Glover. That's those are some mighty big shoes to fill, so hopefully I won't disappoint.
David Walker, who for years was one of the biggest film critics in the Portland area, when he did work for the Willamette Week, he organized the Long Bow Film Festival, which was sort of the flip side of the Sundance Film Festival. Talk about that a little bit. Talk about your career a little bit.
Well, as you mentioned, I worked at Willamette Week for many years. I started as a freelancer there in the late 90s, then went on staff in 2000. I was there till 2007 as the screen editor, lead film critic, and just an overall flunky over there. And at some point, they asked me to put together a film festival for them. I think they wanted to sort of reach out into the film culture landscape. And so I put together the Long Bow Film Festival, which was named after Harry Long Bow, which is the birth name of the Sundance Kid, because I thought I was being clever, but most people never quite got that reference. So I would have to explain to them. They'd say, what's a Long Bow? And I'd say, Long Bow is here, it's the Sundance Kid's real name. And then they go, oh, that's cool. And so I ran that festival, I think, for like about 5 years, I guess, from 2002 or 3 till 2007. And was just trying to bring a level of eclectic cinema, just a very eclectic overview of cinema. So I wanted to just show, I wanted to bring films that I wanted to see, but also films that I thought other people would benefit from viewing. And that story.
People might remember the film Darius.
Darius Goes West, yes.
Which I loved that film. And talk a little bit about that. It's a movie day. We're going to have fun. I know there's wars going on all over the world. There's probably some kind of, something's going to break out on Mars too. But let's talk about movies. Darius Goes West, so that was a juicy one.
Yeah. No, Darius Goes West was a documentary that had been submitted to Long Bow during its last year. So that would be 2007. And when I got it, I got the DVD and I looked at the description, and all I read was, you know, blah, 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 wheelchair, blah, 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 muscular dystrophy, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, I really don't want to watch a movie about a kid with muscular dystrophy, which is ultimately what the film's about.
But
it turned out to be probably the single most influential film I've seen in my life. It's a film about a young man with Duchenne muscular dystrophy and his friends taking him from Athens, Georgia, his hometown, which he's never left, cross country to get his wheelchair customized on MTV's Pimp My Ride.
And they didn't know they were going to be able to get on that show because, of course, no one had ever done that before.
Yep.
And we're talking about an African-American youth in the wheelchair, Darius, yep. African-American youth. And all of his pals, they were all young white men, too.
Yeah.
It was
kind of,
so to me, I mean, I thought there was just an interesting, different kind of play on racial issues there. And that was a fascinating technical opportunity there. You're listening to Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. And we are live in the studio with David Walker. It's the 15th anniversary of his very influential, actually, culture blog, Badass Mofo. We've been talking about the film festival that David organized some few years ago. We were talking about this film, Darius Goes West. And actually, this film, people in Portland, this was a national film festival that David organized here in Portland. And Darius Vegas Goes West. It didn't have any connection with Portland except that they submitted this film to David, and David reached out and grabbed a hold of Darius.
Yeah, yeah. No, I saw the film, and I was incredibly moved by it at the time. That afternoon, I remember watching it on a Sunday. And immediately going through, you know, whenever someone submits a film to a festival, they have all kinds of contact information, their phone number, their email. I found the phone number of the director, this guy, Logan, who at the time was like 22, I think. And I called him immediately and said, look, I just watched your movie. We're going to show it at the festival, but what else can I do? And, you know, by what else can I do? Can I help you raise money? Can I do a charity fundraiser? We wound up having a fundraiser that year at the festival, turn the festival into a fundraiser. I think we were maybe the third festival worldwide to show that Darius Goes West. But since then, I went to Athens, Georgia last summer for Darius Goes West Day and spent the weekend with Darius, who just turned 21 in October. The entire crew shown the film multiple times since then, and really sort of become a proponent and a supporter of that cause. But it's also sort of opened my eyes to just the situation of, you know, young people dealing with disabilities in America. We have a tendency to be very dismissive in this culture of, you know, we see somebody in a wheelchair, we see somebody with some sort of physical disability, and we sort of lump them into this very large catch-all category, and which, of course, is wrong. That's just another form of prejudice and discrimination. And, you know, and a lot of times we become afraid of them. Like it's contagious. Like, whatever they have is contagious. And that creates this sort of an ostracizing effect, which I was guilty of that before, you know, before watching this movie and before getting to know Darius and other people. Now I try my hardest to really, you know, sort of practice what I preach in terms of realizing, okay, you can't just see somebody in a wheelchair or whatever other disability they may have and just jump to the same set of conclusions that a lot of us reach, you know, which is we don't even need to get into them because there's no reason to continue to perpetuate them. What we really need to think about is, like, everybody's a person with feelings and emotions, and what can we do as a society to make life easier for everybody.
We, this morning on Wednesday Morning Talk Radio, we're talking about art and culture. We're talking about us, people sitting together in a room, and what does film reflect about us? And David, I want to start talking about your book, Why's the Brother Gotta Die? Because one of the things that strikes me the most about Portland has a reputation as being a very, very racist city, actually the Pacific Northwest, you know, Klan stronghold going back 100 years. But the arts communities here are so segregated, and people have been talking about that new TV series Portlandia for weeks now. And in my house, the big topic of debate about it is, how come it's all white people?
You mean Whitelandia?
Whitelandia. That, yeah. And my roommate Jamila, she's really kind of just annoyed by it. It's a little fly and she wants to squish it. Actually, Jamila would never squish a fly, ever. She would walk it outside and let it go. But our town is so artistically segregated. And when people look at that show Portlandia, it's like, well, it looks like that because there's no black people here. I'm like, actually, don't erase the people.
Yeah, no, they're here. It's just Portland is a very odd town in terms of how it's in the sort of the segregation lines that have been drawn more to a large extent voluntarily. It's sort of like,
who do you want to be with, and whose cell phone number do you have?
Yeah, exactly. It's not like 1938 here. It's more like maybe 1958 when there actually was a choice in a lot of major northern cities, and Portland just sort of made the decision, we're just going to keep things the way they are, keep them status quo, which is very frustrating. You know, in the arts community too, you know, film, music. This is someone was talking to me the other day saying how he wanted to promote a show and bring George Clinton and the P-Funk All-Stars here, and I just said, yeah, but only white people are going to go to that show. You know, I mean, this is the only city I've been to where I'll go see like a hip hop show and, like, I can count the five black people on my hands. I know them all. I've got their numbers in my cell phone, and we go have lunch on a regular basis. So,
on the other hand, Roe Deasy, one of our favorite writer poets, just wrote, she just published a biography about OG1.
Okay.
DJ OG1, who's the official DJ of the Portland Trailblazers. And so there's this burning all, there's this burning other community of people who, people of color that go to shows that don't always interact with the other people that go to the other shows. And this is what I want to, I mean, I want to throw open the phone lines. What really, to me, what matters the most about this is that, is our kids. Mm-hmm. And our kids are in these silos. We call them schools. We call them high schools. And so you have some kids, especially kids who are middle class kids and above, who are going to school. They've got a dream for the future. They can make that dream happen, although not so much now. But they can make that dream happen. And then you have other kids going to the same schools, and they somehow, they're looking at a great big wall. And it's, you know, it's economic. I think it's racial. And yet, to me, this is why it could be important that we get communities together to share our visions and our images of what, who we are and how we are together, which goes back to your book, How do black people get killed in films? I mean, because that really matters. I mean, that matters because this is what we see of ourselves, and this is what our kids see. And my kids see this Portlandia TV show, and they are hurling. They just think it's, they don't want anything to do with it. It's stupid. And it is actually stupid. You know, on one level, the people making some of these films, it's, they're just having fun, and they're not trying to make a statement, and they don't really care about what you think the statement should be. But anyway, this is our conversation, 503-231-8187. What's your take on why it matters what we're seeing on the tube? You know, it does matter. But okay, so that's a number to call. That's a conversation. Now talk about this book, David. Where did this book come from? What's it about?
This book came from conversations I had as a kid. You know, when I was a kid with my cousins and my friends growing up, we would watch movies on TV. This is back before TV had remote controls and there was no...
You had to get up.
Yeah, had to get up to change a channel. But we would watch these movies, and it always seemed like inevitably whenever there was a black character in a movie, they would get killed off. My first conscious memory of this was watching the original Planet of the Apes, where one of the astronauts was a black guy, and I was maybe 5 years old. I was watching it with a kid from down the street, and he looked over at me. The moment we saw all three of the astronauts and one of them was black, he said, "Ooh, the brother's gonna die," and it, you know, freaked me out as a kid. I'm like five. And lo and behold, after like the third commercial break, the black guy gets killed. And and then as I grew older, I would see all these movies, you know, growing up in the 70s and the 80s, where it seemed like, again, inevitably, and I sort of debunked that myth, because not every black character gets killed in every science fiction film or every horror film that you see, but in an awful lot of them, a lot of the popular ones, they do. And so that's been like this raging debate. You know, you're in high school and you're in college, you go to the movies with your friends, and at some point you're always asking, well, at least black folks are always asking, why does the brother got to die, you know? And it got to that point where I had asked that question so many times, where as a film critic and as something of a historian, film historian, and I'd like to think a cultural historian, I had to start, like, really seriously asking that question, because nobody was asking that question seriously. I've yet to read a very serious dissertation. I've read a couple interesting theories, and I wasn't about to write anything that was super academic, because I'm not a super academic person, but I did want to get into, like, the real reasons behind it. There had to be a reason, because it's become an archetype or a cliche or a stereotype. All those terms fit into that spectrum of, you know, the disposable black character in film.
But this is the thing that worries me, is that when we, in Portland, I'm walking down the street, I'm reading the newspaper, and I see young African-American men and women who are also, I mean, in so many ways, a person could argue that our young people are also disposable.
Yes, they
What's
are.
That about?
Yes, they are. Well, I get into that into the book. I mean, that what we're getting into is a very deep-rooted historical, you know, and people will just flip out as I start talking about this. But it's an institutional form of racism that goes back to even before, you know, the colonization of the United States. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about it is the myth of black inferiority and the myth of white superiority in which this entire nation has been built. And it seems kind of silly to a lot of people, it seems silly to talk about, like, the black guy in Night of the Living Dead getting killed off, being tied into this sort of systemic racism that's been going on literally for hundreds and hundreds of years. And that's what it comes down to. It comes down to that culturally we have been conditioned to think that black people are inferior to white people. We all think it. Every person in this country thinks it. It doesn't matter. Even myself as a black man, I've still been conditioned to think this way, and I have to reprogram my brain to realize that this is untrue, that this isn't how it really is. But a lot of it goes back to the justification. In order to enslave an entire group of people, you have to have some sort of justification for that. And that justification for slavery in North America was that black people are not human beings, that they are animals, and that they are deserving of, they don't deserve more than what they have. And while that specific thought process is not prevalent anymore, for the most part, in this society, there are remnants of it that have remained. And those remnants are what inform every single aspect of the racial dynamic and racial dialogue in this country.
Okay.
And again, it sounds really silly to think about it in the terms of, in a sort of pop culture term.
In terms of Planet of the Apes. But there it is. It's on the table. You can't walk away from it. And that's why I'm so glad that you're our guest, David Walker, today. We have a full slate of callers. I think that these deep conceptual waters resonate with a lot of people. We're talking about the screwed up creation myth of our American culture. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. We have a caller. LJ, uh-oh. What's going on, LJ? What's your take?
Uh-oh, Lisa, uh-oh. Thank you so much for the show. Okay, can we talk about the black exploitation film festivals of the 70s, like Shaft, like Superfly, like Foxy Brown, etc.? When Melvin Van Peebles released Sweet Sweet Back's Badass Song, and Hollywood discovered that black people go to the movies too, the marketplace was flooded with what I call black exploitation films. And can we talk about how that genre kind of was a double-edged sword, because it reinforced black stereotypes? You know, oh God, you know, if you're driving a Cadillac, you must be a pimp. Yada 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 yada, and that whole thing.
Thanks a lot for calling, LJ.
Okay, thank you. Take care. Have a good day.
David Walker, as it happens, knows a tiny little bit about blaxploitation films.
Just a little bit.
But let's go to a couple more callers, and then we'll, because that's a big iceberg we could just dig into.
Okay.
So let's go back to the phone lines. We have Deimos on the phone. Did I say your name right?
Yes, that's correct.
What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to bring up, as a black person who grew up in Georgia and moved here to Portland over 5 years ago, I don't understand why blacks here seem to be marginalized or so. People always talk about how there's no black people here and whatnot, but there's like tens of thousands of black people here. I see blacks every day that I walk outside my front door, and I live in inner southeast Portland. So, and the things, I go to shows all the time, I go to demonstrations, I go to all kinds of events and stuff, you know. And I see all kinds of people and whatnot. I mean, yeah, the majority of people here are white, but there's all kinds of different people here, you know. So, I mean, you can see what you want to see and whatnot. So I just wanted to put out that there's plenty of black people here, and you just have to, you know where to look and whatnot. And also wanted to bring up to your guest, since you wanted to bring up the black guy, you know, being dying in that night or Return of the Living Dead, I'm a big, horror movie fan myself, so you should at least give props to George A. Romero, who typically makes the centerpiece of his films.
He's mentioned thoroughly in the book.
Thanks a ton for calling.
Thank you.
You know, I like that he called and brought that up, because in the Native American community, they call that erasure.
Mm-hmm.
When people, where I grew up in Fremont, we had everyone in the elementary schools. You know, in Portland schools, everybody has to build a model of a bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Where I was growing up, everybody had to use sugar cubes to build a model of a mission. You know, Father Junipero Serra, he did these horrible missions all across California. And We learned the Ohlone Indians, they're extinct and la, 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 la. Well, no, they're not. In fact, they're not. And we have the same thing in Oregon, and that term is erasure. The city of Portland just did some demographic studies that showed there's approximately, 55,000 African-American people, self-identified African-American people in Portland. I don't think that includes African people. Sometimes African people will not tick that box. People just have a different view of who they are. But there are people here. They're not invisible, and I do think it's true what Damo said, is that people think they're invisible, and it's goes back to a very important piece of literature there, actually, The Invisible Man.
Yes, and I think that part of that invisibility comes from the the way the city's set up. It's a very odd dynamic, because while there are a significant number of African Americans in the city, and definitely more so now. See, well, you also have to distinguish between people who've lived in Portland for, say, 20 or 30 years, who've really, and those who've moved here within, like, the last 5-10 years and seen a greater sense of diversity, I would believe. But, it's totally possible to be in certain neighborhoods in the city and just sort of walk around for a couple hours and never see very few people of color. Or conversely, the people of color you see are sort of almost like a turtle in their shell. So they're trying not to be noticed, because there comes a time where you just feel like, okay, I just do not want, if I'm going to go to the bank, I'll go to the bank in my neighborhood where they know me, as opposed to the bank over on Northwest 23rd, where when I walk in, I'm automatically convinced they're going to look at me like I'm going to rob the place.
Yeah, the rental cop is twitching his gun. Anyway, this is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. Our guest this morning is David Walker. It's the 15th anniversary year of his culture blog, Badass Mofo, and he's come out with a new book of essays. It's called Why Is the Brother Gotta Die? We're talking about race, we're talking about neighborhoods and culture, and the number to call, 503-231-8187. We have Joanne on the phone. Joanne, what is your take? What movies did your kids watch when they were little?
Lisa, somebody was talking about disposable people. I've known for a long time that old women in my class have been disposable for generations. Also, what about attention for biracial children? Thanks for the program.
Thanks, Joanne. Last year, this awesome documentary came out about biracialism. I have to think of what it was called. You know what? I'm going to have to dig that up, because where I work, our reviewer had a long essay about it. He was just taken by it. Do you know which one I'm talking about, David?
No, I don't, and I'd actually like to see that, because that's another subject that I have yet to really delve into too heavily, is that sort of biracial or multiracial or multicultural. I get, when I was a kid growing up, because I am what they describe as biracial, there weren't any politically correct terms to describe kids like me when I was growing up, and no attempts made for inclusion. You had to choose one side, and whatever side you chose inevitably didn't want you anyway. Neither side wanted you, and it was it wasn't part of the national dialogue. And now that's obviously changed quite a bit with Barack Obama, but it's still a very difficult place to be in. I think especially difficult for older people. When I say older, myself, people that are, not that I'm ancient by any stretch of the imagination, but definitely people over, I'll say, the age of 30, who again grew up in an era where it was like you were not made to feel welcome anywhere, but yet you still had to find a way to fit in, and as a result you begin to develop this outside observer sort of perspective, where you look at everything from both sides, because your family gatherings sometimes are, these incredible racial and racist rants and raves and dialogues where you get to hear the most ridiculous and some of the most profound statements ever made, and you realize that all and none of them apply to you in every capacity imaginable. So that's something that I think really, in terms of film, there's hardly any characters ever that are biracial. You see them so rarely and so infrequently. And I even talk about that a little bit in the book when I talk about both Vin Diesel and Dwayne Johnson, The Rock, who are, you know, fairly reasonable action heroes, but no one ever talks about them in the context of either being black or half black. They're almost always presented as white guys.
And yet with those two guys in particular, and we do have a full slate of callers, we're going to go to the phone in a second, but with those two guys in particular, I feel like that thing, it just kind of hangs in the air.
Yeah.
You know, as a viewer, especially they're so macho, although, I mean, I really like Dwayne Johnson, and I feel as though he just made a film this past year that was ruthlessly panned, but it showed him in a more emotional light. But still, I just think that, though, this is one of these things that's in front of us every day.
Yeah.
And we do think about it, but do we actually process it, and do we have words for it? And I do want to say, this documentary that I'm thinking about, maybe it's called I'm Not Black. I can't remember. And maybe, in fact, our magical engineering pixie is looking for it online. But that was sort of the plot of it. Why do I have to choose? And it's interviews with biracial people from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And the one that really got me was a little girl in the playground, and she she's asked, what color are you? And then she basically, she's like 7 years old, and she says, people keep asking me, they keep telling me I have to choose. Why do I have to choose? And I mean, and I know that there's excerpts of this on YouTube, and I see the engineering pixie. He's in the air room, and he's running around, and there's lights going on. And we do have three callers. I want to see if we can go to the phone lines. We have Mitch on the phone. Mitch, what do you think about this topic?
Well, I think it's a great topic. I mean, race is a problem we've had here in this country for years and years and years. I'd like to ask David, because I haven't read the book, are you white?
No.
Are you darker? Or
I am, I guess we'll say biracial is the best one. My father was black, my mother was white. And when I was growing up and you were forced to make a decision back in those days, I chose to be black.
David Walker looks exactly like Vin Diesel. If you saw him on the street, you go, oh, my God.
No, I don't know about that. But
I had a childhood kind of coming from a small town in Texas as a child of like seven,
mm-hmm,
to L.A. and cast into a black situation, me and my mom and siblings, okay, and we're white,
mm-hmm,
okay? But we were suddenly thrust into the realm of blackness and the projects there in L.A. And the first thing out of our mouth to these kids next door was we wasn't allowed to play with them, okay, because that's the way we were kind of taught.
Mm-hmm.
They had a little, the N-word.
Mm-hmm.
If you lived on that side of the tracks, that was in town, okay? And that's kind of the way we were indoctrinated into our Texas lives. Nothing against Texas, beautiful state. But being thrust into the blackness of Los Angeles, and this is the early 60s, okay? We had racial riots, we had this, we had that. Everybody hated the different colors. But coming from where we did is maybe not so unique, but my mother, bless her heart, she got knocked up by a black man.
Okay. Mitch, come to the point, okay? Come to the point now, because we have a whole slate of callers, and you're going on and on. So,
right. Well, the white race, if you embrace the black race as brothers and equals, in those days, you were labeled an N-lover, N-word lover, okay? So that N-word, it's coming back into our vocabulary today. I was watching Sanford and Son, and they're saying it all over the place.
All right. Okay. All right. Thanks a lot, Mitch. Thanks for calling. We do have a full slate of callers, and we have Mike on the phone. Mike, what do you think about it, Mike? Mike, you need to turn your radio down.
Mitch, come to the point, okay? Come to the point now. Because
okay, let's cut Mike down there, and we need to move on because people are crowding these phone lines. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. Live in the studio, we've got Dave Walker. He's talking about his book, Why Is the Brother Gotta Die? It's an analysis of race and film. We're talking about how that plays out in our neighborhoods, and we do have another caller. We have Joe on the line. Joe, what's your take?
Yeah, just to throw a little bit of humor into the situation, I'm sure you're familiar with a lady by the name of Aisha Tyler, comedian, actress.
Mm-hmm.
She
yes.
used to host, did any of you guys happen to see her when she hosted the cable show called E! Entertainment? It was called Talk Soup.
Yes.
It was a show on E! Entertainment was the channel, and then Talk Soup was the name of the show. But she used to make fun of all the black sexploitation films, and she was Foxy Brown. And if you get a chance, I don't know if there's any way of doing it, of going back and looking at any of the old episodes, because she probably hasn't been on the air in 5 years. But I'd recommend those, because she had a pretty good take on them. It was really funny. And then she also did another episode where she would dress up as a about a 1790s black African slave woman that was like the house, you know, they had your farms, you know, the ones that worked out in the field and the ones that worked in the house. So she was
Gone with the Wind sort of thing, yeah.
And she made fun of all the black, it was called Black, And I have a hard time pronouncing the word, colloquialisms.
All right, Joe, cool.
So check that out sometime. It was really funny, and Aisha Tyler is the tops. I think she's great. So.
Thanks a lot, Joe. Joe says go listen to Aisha Tyler. And the engineering pixie did come up with the film that I was thinking of. It's called I'm Not Black, Damn It. It's by Battle Cat Productions. Carolyn Battle Cochran, super interesting woman. She was the director-producer of that. I really recommend
that. Check that out.
And there's a whole bunch of excerpts of that on YouTube, so you could just go to your computer and watch it. And we have Mike back. Mike, did you turn your computer? Did you turn your radio down?
I turned my radio down.
Right on, Mike. What's going on?
Hey, I just wanted to say, as far as that word, you know, the N-word, one has to ask an important question because, you know, with everybody listening to rap music, a lot of people feel like they just want to be able to repeat the words that they hear in the music, and a lot of white people don't understand why black people don't want them to say it, but I think the important question is, why would you want to say it?
That is a very good point, Mr. Crenshaw. Thank you for calling in, sir.
Thanks, Mike. Wait, Mike. Stay on the line. Tell us a little bit about what work you're doing lately. What's going on with you?
I'm just doing a lot of construction work right now because I have a new kid. So I'm still playing music. We're doing the Black Thought show tomorrow at the Refuge.
And Mike and I are actually in the beginning process of talking about doing what are we thinking about calling it, the Black Rebel Film Festival, maybe?
The Black Rebel Film Festival, yeah. David and I need to come together on that, but hopefully we're going to be doing that later this year in Portland.
Yeah. Mike, I want to ask you this. Since we have you on the line, we've got Mike Crenshaw on the line, another amazing cultural figure here in Portland for a lot of people. And you've, in the past, you've worked with kids, you've done so much stuff. Mike, what's your take on how the things that we watch on the screen play out in our neighborhoods?
Well, you know, there's a lot of stereotypes and archetypes that you see portrayed of black and brown people in movies. And I think for me personally, unfortunately, I look like one of those archetypes. So what happens is, a lot of times for our men and women of law enforcement and all the little private security firms, when they make eye contact with me, they something happens, like a chemical reaction happens in their psyche, and they want to attack me. And that's something that I've dealt with regularly in Portland, and it's a real fact of life. And a lot of people don't believe it. But just the other week, I was walking downtown in the parking lot, and Portland Clean and Safe basically wrote me an exclusion order just for walking in the parking lot. And it was funny because when they were doing the paperwork, a lot of white people were walking in the parking lot too, but they didn't stop any of them.
It's an interesting thing because and I go back to talking about how we're all conditioned this way. I've known Mike for many, many years, but before I actually met him, I was like, yeah, that guy's kind of scary looking. I don't want to talk to him. You know, I mean, we bring the prejudices that society has conditioned with us into our own interactions. I see him now, and I'm like, I don't see it. I don't see the guy that he's describing, that the cops or whoever react to. But before I actually knew him, and I get that same reaction to a large extent, that not as much as I used to. Maybe it's because I'm getting older and more gray hair or something. I look more like Fred Sanford than Vin Diesel. But but I do think that you know, we do carry a lot of that individually within ourselves. And that's the hard part. And the hard part is to condition ourselves not to see our brothers and sisters of any race, of any culture, of any you know, disposition, as a threat, as the other. Because at the end of the day, we're all human beings, no matter what sort of package we come in, or we should be striving to be human beings.
Mm. Mike Crenshaw, just can you let our listeners know where they can go to find out more about where you're doing shows or what you're doing in the near future?
Yeah, just hit me, Mike Crenshaw, on Facebook, Facebook.com/Mike Crenshaw. That's M-I-C, not M-I-K-E. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Or go to MikeCrenshaw.com. And like I said, I'll be performing at the Refuge tomorrow night. And look for the Black Rebel Film Festival that will be produced by David Walker and myself.
Excellent. Thanks a lot for calling in. I think Mike Crenshaw is an awesome poet. I don't always know if people want to hear me say that I think they're awesome poets, but he's a really cool guy. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. Live in the studio, we're with David Walker. We're all celebrating the 15th anniversary of his culture blog, Badass Mofo, and we're talking about his book of essays that he just came out with, Why's the Brother Gotta Die? We're looking at what happens on screen, and how does that play out in our neighborhoods? And we do have a couple more callers. I really, though, David, somebody asked about blaxploitation films, and I really wanted to take a moment for you to be able to talk about your take on blaxploitation films. You love them, I think.
Yes.
Maybe you love them and sometimes also hate them, but you've written about them extensively. And just for people who are listening, if you did want to call, 503-231-8187 is the number to call to get on the air if you have some comments. But talk with, you know, the deep conceptual waters of blaxploitation films.
Sure, and I'll try to be as brief as possible, but I think LJ said it best when he said that it was a double-edged sword. The blaxploitation films came along in the early 70s, although the antecedents go back into the 60s, and were really a reflection of post-civil rights America. They weren't so much a reflection of the changes that had taken place as they were sort of fantasy wish fulfillment of what we wish we could have achieved. They were more of a reflection of the militancy that had come out during that era. He mentioned Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, which was very much reflective of the ideology that was being presented by the Black Panther Party. So blaxploitation films came along and created a sort of fantasy iconography of Black power. Black power as reflected through the lens of Hollywood, which had already given us things like, you know, characters like James Bond and things like that, these sort of larger than life action heroes. And so in that regard, it was very influential in changing the way Black folks were viewed on camera, because before that it was always the sort of step and fetch it, you know, just these really horrible comedic stereotypes, or I'm drawing a blank, but the woman from Gone with the Wind, Hattie McDaniel, who won the Best Supporting Actress for Gone with the Wind. There was only a small group of stereotypes that Black actors could be cast as. Those stereotypes all sort of imploded during the blaxploitation era. They were created by new character types, which then would eventually go on to become stereotypes in and of themselves. There's been a lot written about how negative those films were, and those negative images, films like Superfly and the Mac that sort of glorified the anti-hero as hero. Well, first of all, that goes back to film from the very beginning. I mean, the most popular films in the 30s and 40s were always the gangster films with Jimmy Cagney and Edward G. Robinson, Humphrey Bogart. Everybody loves a good bad guy. So the problem with a film like Superfly or the Mac was not so much that these were anti-heroes that were criminals that we were glorifying. It was that there was never a flip side to that imagery. Whereas with films that deal with white characters, you might have a film like, say, you know, Public Enemy or Little Caesar, whatever horrific glorification of gangsterism that we might have seen in the 30s and 40s, but it was always balanced out by something like, you know, It's a Wonderful Life, you know, some sort of Frank Capra or George Cukor film. Black films never had that. So you had Superfly and Shaft. You know, maybe you got something like Claudine or Cooley High, but by and large, there was never that that counterbalance of seeing Black folks in the sort of everyday human roles.
What about Spike Lee movies? Do you think that Spike Lee, like, maybe brought that? And by the way, Spike Lee's coming to the Pacific Northwest in February, I think, to that big college in Tacoma. Okay. But, I mean, I feel as though there's a couple breakout.
There always have been. You know, unfortunately, historically, most people don't know about them. Charles Burnett's Killer of Sheep, which came out in 1977, is arguably the single greatest depiction of the inner city black experience that's ever been committed to film. Most people have never seen that. A couple of white guys in 1965 made a movie called Nothing But a Man with Ivan Dixon, which is also an incredible film. Most people don't remember those. They don't remember Gordon Parks's The Learning Tree. Spike did a lot of things to change the perception and the way black people are portrayed in film. But so did other, you know, to a certain extent, so did Richard Pryor and so did Eddie Murphy. I don't think we've arrived yet at a point. First off, I don't think film in general has arrived at a point where people are presented as real human beings in film. It doesn't matter. We still have a long way to go in terms of how we portray women and how we portray any other minority that we can think of or people with disabilities. But in general, we're just these sort of one-dimensional characters in film. It's just worse if you're not a white guy. So.
Okay, I have to jump in and say, coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, Jay Thiemeyer speaks with Dr. Margaret Flowers of Physicians for a National Health Program about a single-payer health care program and single-payer health care statewide conference coming up this weekend in Portland. Later in the hour, Sue Cipriano speaks with environmental activist Samantha Chirillo about biomass and the cutting down of old-growth forests for corporate profit. At 10, it's Eric Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on the Recovery Zone, Stephanie Potter speaks with three people who want us to re-examine our relationship to the death penalty and to the idea that violence is an appropriate solution to social problems. This is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving. We're live in the studio with David Walker. It's the 15th anniversary of his culture blog, Badass Mofo, and we're talking about his new book of essays, Why's the Brother Gotta Die?, examining why black characters get killed in movies. David Walker, and before this hour is up, we'll let you know how you can get a copy of that. David, I know we've got a full slate of callers, and I want to get them to them in a second, but here's the thing we have not really talked about yet. I think a lot of people don't think about where do movies come from? And when we're talking about how people are characterized in a film, dude, there's a screenwriter who just spent 6 months in a cave, blocking out these characters and everything they do. Yep. It's almost like the conspiracy in a dark, smoky room. When we talk about how people are characterized as a group, when we talk about stereotypes, somebody is sitting there and thinking about that. And why are they doing it? They're putting it on paper. They planned this whole thing, and they're doing it for money. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we haven't really talked about that. You know, I feel as though that's the same issue with President Obama and the State of the Union Address. This morning, I was listening to Harry Belafonte on Democracy Now, and Amy Goodman's like, are you disappointed in Obama? And he basically says, actually, Obama does what Obama does. I'm disappointed that people aren't making him do his job better, right? Sometimes I feel like with film, it's the same thing. I mean, as consumers, who do we demand that they do a better job? I don't mean to be weird about it. Someone's planning this. It's almost like it's a conspiracy, except conspiracy is too much work. It's a profit motive to make us all look like this in movies.
Well, and you hit the nail on the head when you said consumer. Film is a consumer-based product, and we as the audience are the consumers, but most of us don't think that way. So Friday night rolls around, and we want to go to the movies with, you know, our husbands or wives or girlfriends or our kids, and we look through the paper and we go, well, what should we go see? And we make a decision based on maybe what, you know, Ebert and Roper gave it two thumbs up, or the fact that, you know, Tom Cruise is in it, or that it's a Tyler Perry movie, whatever the reason is. And we go, and if it's terrible, we don't say anything. We might tell our friends, oh, it was a bad movie, but we continue to support that product. We don't treat film as we treat other consumer-based products. So, you know, if a car company puts out cars with faulty brakes, people stop buying those cars, or they demand a recall, or they do whatever. People don't do that with film. They don't say, oh, you know what? I'm not going to go to movies right now. Movies are $12 a piece. I'm going to stop going until the studios and the exhibitors decide to lower the price. We don't think of ourselves as having any sort of consumer-based rights when it comes to film. And so when you begin with just that understanding, you realize that's why we get away with everything. That's why they get away with everything that they show us. Because no one's, you know, there's no accountability. As long as you know, whatever terrible movie's coming out this weekend makes $50 million when it opens, they'll keep making movies like that. Now, when people stop going to the movies and stop buying the DVDs that they don't want, then, you know, then they might change their tune. As far as the people who write them, I don't think they're making necessarily conscious decisions to say, you know, I'm guilty of this. If I write a script, I'm terrible at writing women characters, and I realize that. And I said to somebody the other day, if I were to make another film, I think I would want to make a film that was with all women, that was like true to femininity, but wasn't like some sort of joke. It didn't treat women as a joke. It wasn't at the expense of their femininity, if that makes sense. Because to me, as a writer now, that represents a new challenge, to write female characters that aren't female characters. They're just human beings, but they also happen to be women. That's what every screenwriter should be striving to do. But most don't strive to do that. They just strive to make money. Hence the reason I don't have any money, because I'm concerned with the uplifting of the entire human race.
Which is interesting when you think about Tyler Perry writing so many successful movies with him in a woman's suit. Anyway, we have a whole lineup of callers. Let's go to the phone lines. We have Lena on the phone. Sorry to make you wait. We're just our blowhards over here. Lena, what's your take on this topic?
Well, I just wanted to, first of all, thank you for even introducing the topic. It's a topic that I think about quite often. In fact, I think I've ruined many movies for the people I've watched movies with, because I cannot help but notice, I'll be sitting there and I'll be thinking, you know, it's really great that the hero is, you know, this big white guy. Why is the black guy his sidekick? Why are they never the superheroes? You know, why is it like this? So, I mean, as far as any comments I have to make, I just wanted to thank you for the dialogue, because it's amazing how many people don't want to talk about it or think about it. They just want to watch the movie, and I feel like that's true with all audiences, even people of color. I've found that a lot of times they will even buy into the stereotype and kind of embrace it, and that's something.
And then they live the stereotype too, but that's another subject altogether.
Thanks a right. lot, Lena. Thanks for yeah. calling in. And we
Thank
have another
you.
We have another caller. We have Shara on the phone. Shara, what's your take? Sorry to make you wait so long.
Oh, no problem. So, I mean, in listening to all this stuff about the films, I mean, some things I think about are, I grew up in Southern California in a multi-racial community, and I grew up, and then I moved to Portland, and I moved to Northeast Portland, and I didn't really think anything of the fact that I lived in a mostly African-American community until a few weeks later, when many people like pointed it out to me.
We lost her. We're gonna move on, and we'll hope that Shara calls back. Now we have Jackson on the phone. Jackson, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. How you guys doing?
We're doing okay. Wonderful. We're just in the deep conceptual waters. What's your take?
Hey, okay, thanks for taking my call. I just had to say, you know, you were making the comic about Portlandia. Now, I don't watch the show, but it's always been kind of like my pet peeve, and it made me think. Perhaps it's Nielsen ratings that had something to do with how or why the script didn't include the diversity of people. You know, I haven't seen the show, but, I mean, are there any Asians in the show?
I don't think so.
Well, it goes back to the writing. And these people are trying to make money for their sponsors and all that. They're going, well, you have no control over whether or not a person can change that dial or not. So how do we captivate them? And it's like maybe they're putting all their chickens in one basket because they feel like they don't want to take any chances. That's all.
But, you know, the other thing about this that we've had the discussion in my household, Jackson, is I bet, first of all, the people that make this don't know any people that don't look like them. You know?
Well, that's true, but I made the point towards Nielsen ratings.
Yeah.
They have the technology. They have a pretty good idea of the demographics of what they're doing for their sponsors. So that's the point I'm making. They know who are watching the show, and it leads to a much deeper subject that I don't, you know, this show we really don't have time to get into. But I just wanted to put my two cents into it.
Really appreciate your calling.
All right, then. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot. Just basic, you know, what's your take, David?
Well, I'll break it down like this. You know, here's what it comes down to. I just had this conversation with someone not that long ago. You look at the original Star Wars movie, which came out in 1977. It was the highest grossing movie of all time at that time, and it continues to be one of the highest grossing movies of all time. There was not a single black person in Star Wars.
Jar Jar Binks. I'm not even going that one.
What's that about?
Sorry, I'm not yelling. I'm not yelling. Stop it.
But the 1977 version of Star Wars, you know, episode whatever, 4 it was, I believe. Again, the highest grossing movie in the world. Everyone I know saw it. Every black person I know saw it. We all saw it. Asian, black, Latino, white, didn't matter. And going back to the message it sends, that sends a message that it doesn't matter if you only have a movie with white people in it, because everyone will go see it anyway. And it's the same thing to a certain extent with, you know, and I'm not going to knock the Harry Potter movies. They're fun. I like watching them, but there's hardly any diversity in those either. But same with the Spider-Man movie. Same with every single movie. Most of the biggest blockbusters out there are by and large, very white films. And the fact that we all go see them sends that message loud and clear that we don't care. As an audience, we, you know, people like you and I and the listeners will sit around and we'll dialogue about it. But, you know, I think it was it Lena who said it? Her, you know, her friends probably think she's annoying after a while when you're sitting there and just, you know.
You're trying to escape.
Exactly.
It's a strange concept in among what we're talking about, too. And Shara is back. And I just want to say, though, really quickly, Francis Ford Coppola's production of Finian's Rainbow, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's a really weird one. And if you want to be weirded out by racial demographics in a movie, go see that movie. But let's go back to Shara. Shara, she lived in Los Angeles. She moved to Northeast Portland. She didn't think much about the neighborhood until she saw a big crowd of people walking down the street. Okay, go, Shara.
So anyhow, the people in my neighborhood, African American people, really kind of just pointed out to me that how out of place I was, that here I was a white person in a mostly black neighborhood. And I guess I just am wondering about, you know, just to bring it back local, like about reverse racism, about self-segregation, and does the media, do movies encourage that? Do they encourage black people to stay with black people and white people to stay with white people? And maybe, like, how can blacks and whites alike, like, encourage like a more diverse community and step away from this North Killingsworth line that seems to separate us.
All right, thanks for calling. What do you think about that, David? I mean, is it reverse racism when people want to be with their own family or their own neighbors? What do you think?
I don't think that it's necessarily reverse racism, but what I think is that it's not necessarily thinking in the bigger picture. I don't want to get into this whole Zen philosophy about it, but there comes a point where we need to realize that we are all human beings. And, you know, and I never want to, you know, compare myself to thinking the way Sting thought when he wrote, you know, that Do Russians Love Their Children song. But, you know, most of us with children love our children. We love our parents. And, you know, we cry when our dog gets killed. The emotions that we have as human beings are very universal. But what we do is we apply these various different labels, whether it's race or religion, or we base it upon the amount of money that we earn. And that's what we use to separate each other. And you know, that's the big problem. I mean, I grew up in a very diverse neighborhood before I moved here to Portland when I was a kid. And, you know, it was just your neighbors. You know, you never really thought about it. I think that dynamic is very different here in Portland. And I guess the only way to really change it is just we have to treat each other like human beings.
Get to know each other. Whose cell phone number do you have? Who do you want to be with? To me, it often comes back to that. I just want to say thanks for tuning in. This was a pretty rollicking dialogue today. Yeah. And we are closing out this show. This has been Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. Now, David Walker, badassmofo.com.
Yes,
right?
BADASZMOFO.com.
Now, and the book is Why's the Brother Gotta Die? Where are people getting it?
You can just get it off the website. There's the most recent update is how to order it.
Fantastic. And this is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio. I'm Lisa Loving. The podcast of this show is going to be available at KBOO.FM by the end of today. And I want to thank all the people who called. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for Political Perspectives.